You're listening to episode 60. And now, our exclusive interview with Sean J. Period here on Take It Personal Radio.
What?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special guest. We have the man who goes by Sean J. Period. He is, to me, one of the handful of producers from this indie era that has really helped shape the sound that we've come to love. So when you think of Spinna and LP and RJ and High Tech and Necrodilla, Alchemist, you know, Sean J's right there. You know, he's in that conversation of people that have had monumental classic records. And I'm excited to talk to Sean J. Sean, what up, man?
Hey, thank you. Great to be with you all.
Thanks for stopping by. So there's a lot, there's a bunch of us here. There's a lot we all want to talk about, but I'd always like to kind of give the listeners, you know, the backstory, you know, the timeline of really how it all began. So before we even get into that whole indie era movement, if you will, in 94, which was, it's almost like a gift and a curse when you think about it. In 94, you dropped a record, your record, right? Down South. 94, down South, arguably, yeah, one of the greatest years in hip hop. And, you know, with all the classics that came out every Tuesday, it was very hard, right, to get, you know, the proper shine, if you will. So for those that do not know, and maybe those that do know, I mean, take us back to you being on Big Beat, which is, a subsidiary of Atlantic Records.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and your group Down South. Now, Brooklyn's known to rip a mania show. Have a mania phone is what we were told.
Wow.
Actually, we're actually looking at it right now. I had this record. I actually had the double LP that's in on white vinyl.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you get the white? That was
of course. Vinyl. Yeah, because I definitely rolled through it. But that was I always held on to that, man. I thought it was a great record.
So when we got the record, obviously we weren't familiar with Sean J. I think it was years later where we made the connection. So take us to that time in 94. First of all, I want to know, how long were you guys together as Down South? How you got signed to Big Beat? And I know, you know, Bob Beato, and then you had Reef. You had there's a lot of right, interesting characters there. So let's bring it all together so we have a good understanding of how this even began for you.
Initially, it started out as the group was called the J Team, you know, because all of us had last names with J. It was the Jones and John Hot. So my cousin Jeremy and my friend Mayor, from Virginia. He actually grew up in New York, but he moved down to Virginia. So we actually started in the South, you know, growing up in Richmond, Virginia. And Mayor worked at Def Jam. So that's how he actually met Bobito. And then from there, we were working on different things or whatever. Coming down South, we were going to Jack the Rappers and all kinds of different things, you know, just promoting ourselves as a group. And he passed along a demo that we had made. And then Bobito, you know, while working at Def Jam, he liked it. But he and Stretch had their radio show.
This is all live, New York. We hit the black gold Texas tea, then we moved to the north. But we'll never forget the Southern folks are the source that raised us and provided us with just a hint of Southern twang and my vocal thing.
And when you're having grand times, what's that call, y'all? And when you're singing this joint, what's that call, y'all?
He introduced the Stretch. Stretch was actually A&R, the A&R for Big Beat at the time. So from that point, you know, it was a situation where they liked it enough, wanted to sign it, you know, and then we went on. That's how we actually got on Big Beat, you know, Atlantic and stuff like that. And Craig Coleman is funny enough. Craig Coleman is still the president of, or with CEO, however you say it, of Atlantic Records to this day. He was actually over Big Beat when we went there. So that's amazing. Even
that's crazy
that, you know, people like that are still in the game, you know. But they gave us an opportunity. You know, the J Team name didn't necessarily stick. We knew we were going to change it. And we went through all types of iterations of what we were going to be called and stuff like that. And the whole down south thing, we always refer to, yeah, well, we're going back down south, you know, to visit or something like that. And it just seems so simple. And Arrested Development, you know, Atlanta in the South always had, you know, a solid music culture, you know. And I remember Arrested Development, you know, was really big then.
Wasn't that 92 at that time?
It was like, let's say, between 92 and 94. Yeah, like around in that time frame. You know, so, yeah, because definitely when we went to Jack the Rapper, which was right around that time, they were, you know, big on the scene. But the South, specifically Atlanta, you know, obviously you had your Miamis and your Louisiana, all the different things. But that really helped us to really decide, okay, well, we're from down south. So then the album, I think we named the album Up North. I think if I remember, I haven't looked at the album in so long. Tell me what the album says. It says, the album cover is called what?
Well, it says Down South, Lost in Brooklyn, which is confusing. Confusing as fuck for many of us.
That's all we were going to do.
Yeah.
But Lost in Brooklyn. So that's the whole concept was.
You kind of moved up there and
coming
got
from. Yeah. Mayor, he knew what to, you know, he was from New York, so he knew his way around. But it was just our experience of these brothers from the South moving to the North, you know, fumbling their way through the city and stuff like that. But we had some really good people guiding us. You know, the Beatnuts came on, T-Ray, you know, Stretch, Bobito, Reef, who ultimately became the A&R there as well. So this guided us through. So that's basically how we got on Big Beat and were able to release the record and stuff like that.
You mentioned T-Ray, and that's a name that does not get enough it doesn't get talked about, brought up enough and or enough recognition throughout the years. And I know he was like an in-house producer for Big Beat. He did a lot of stuff with he did a lot of stuff for Artifacts, but
Double X Posse,
of course. Mm-hmm. And he went on and did stuff, I think, for Funk Dubious, but that was a different label.
Yeah,
but T-Ray was fucking phenomenal. And
nobody talks about him that much.
No one talks about him. So
he always has like the remix on a B-side or something.
I don't know if he makes music anymore. He does the carnival stuff, right? And he kind of like went in that direction. But what was it like working with him? And did you had to have a little idea that, you know, he was the guy behind certain hits, and, you know, he had some fucking head nodders. I mean,
the funny thing is, my favorite song off that Down South record, unfortunately, was the Tractor Rakes and Hoes track that he did. And
why unfortunately?
Well, because I would have liked it to have been a Sean track, but it was the one that I actually played the most.
It's fascinating, though, with that, and I appreciate that, too. The thing is, when I came to New York, I came to New York to be a rapper. So I was, you know, a rapper in a group. The music was always just a function of me needing tracks to rap on, you know, growing up and stuff. So I didn't necessarily even view myself as like, oh, this producer. You know, it was really Rob and Stretch. They were like, hey, you need to think about being a producer outside of this.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So ultimately, they paired us up with T-Ray, the Beatnuts. But, you know, so I was able to actually study under them, go to their houses, you know, when they were digging, you know, just learning from them. So I view it as, I mean, they were like some of the best teachers that I could have ever asked for, you know, to really help to make my decisions as far as even in being a producer, you know. So and he definitely doesn't get a lot of credit. I mean, he did obviously the Artifact stuff, you know, and like you said, what we talked about, Double X Posse,
Double X Funk Dubious. You know,
he did, I think, some rock stuff. He did Santana, like a bunch of just different things. I mean, he was always pushing it. If anything, he encouraged me that obviously hip hop, you know, was strong and it was the dominant thing that we were about. But he also, I saw him going through the projects. You know, I would go to the studio with him, even when I wasn't there, you know, later on and stuff, when he was doing different projects. And it just encouraged me that, you know, as a producer, you know, you could really, you know, push the envelope and not just do one thing, So, you know, I definitely, you know, accredit just the aspect of that thing of actually pushing myself to do other things to him.
And you really got Stretch on his early production stuff. I mean, before he became, you know, someone who they tried to use on a lot of projects. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, we obviously met him through that. They just brought, he was, like you say, in the label, and it was just, oh, hey, work with these guys, you know. So we were getting to know him just as you all were, technically, through the music. We didn't know him prior to that, you know.
You talked about the Beatnuts being a part of the guiding process for you. Yo, there's some wild dudes back then, man. Probably still now. Talk to us about what it was like being in the room with them putting together beats.
It's not really Spanish all the way, but it's more Afro-Spanish.
Oh, man. The Beatnuts. Well, you see, the thing, when you think about the Beatnuts, you know, you're only thinking about, you know, Les, Juju, mainly. Those were the two that worked on the project.
And then Vic
Padilla was part of it. And Fashion, but Fashion was rapping and stuff like that. So, but same thing, you know, we would go to the houses and all the stuff. But the interesting thing, though, whenever we did a session with them, it wasn't just them that game. It was like their crew. So the Beatnuts at large were like, you know, 10 guys, you know. And I remember being in a studio session one time, and, you know, we're doing it. You know, we did nice Southern boys, and I remember sitting up there, you know, we would have budgets to be able to get food and stuff like that. And I remember looking up with them like, wow, dude, we're feeding everybody, you know, and drinks and everything else. So, I mean, they, as people, you know, they carry a certain persona, but as like interacting with them, it's not really that way. You know, it is a little bit like, I mean, they're boisterous and all that stuff like that, but really cool guys, you know. And I saw Juju recently. He had judged within the last couple of years, he had judged a beat competition, because I do a lot of that stuff, you know, judging beat competitions and stuff. And he came out, and I mean, just such love, man, you know, that I have for them, you know. And those guys are cool, man, you know. They it's a persona on record, you know what I mean? They have a little bit in person, but totally relatable guys. Could talk to them, you know, really great guys. So.
They're one of the first crews. There's a small handful that had a real distinct signature sound.
They did, and they brought in that Lower East Side kind of Latin thing too, you know.
For sure.
So after 94, you dropped the album. It had to be a little tough because, like I said earlier, you came out in a year where it was classic after classic after classic. And I'm talking, it was one of the greatest years in hip hop. So your album, unfortunately, got lost in many people's, you know, list, if you will. So not everybody was like Dre or myself who liked it. I mean, I remember Open Sesame and I was, by the way, was that the first Bobbito appearance on record?
I actually don't know, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
It might be now that I think of it. But, so the record, I don't know, you know,
he did Spin the Bottle though too, didn't he?
Did he? I don't know.
Yeah, I did that.
Okay. The record did what it did. And then, but obviously they saw your talents, Reef saw your talents, and you stayed on. Were you considered like an in-house producer, or you just happened to do a lot of records for Big Beat?
Well, I mean, obviously that was my point of contact to the industry, to New York. Mm-hmm. So once we were released from the label, you know, we went through, man. It was like, you know, you come here to do this thing, and and particularly, you know, music, people who do art, I mean, you wear it on your sleeve, you know, and it's like you validate me in one hand and then the next minute you don't, you know. So we went through like a little depression almost, man. Just like kind of had to get our heads together. And for me, because I had the relationships with Reef and through Big Beat, it was just a thing where, okay, you know, I want to do this independent production thing. So, you know, let me see what's going on. So ultimately, Matt Skills, funny enough, yeah. Matt Skills and I are from the same town.
Oh, really?
But I didn't know him then. You know, he's from Richmond, mm-hmm. you know, in that area. And he was the first person that I did, you know, a record for, you know what I mean? As an independent producer, you know. And I remember I had applied to the post office and everything, man. I was just about to go off, and I just said, you know what? I said, God, just, it has to be something more. And I was just praying about it. And like right at that time, you know, within a couple of weeks, you know, I was talking to Rob, and then I was able to get 3 songs on his album. You know, back then they were cutting half checks, so you would get half of whatever your negotiated was. So I was able to, that actually is what helped me to go off into being an independent producer, was my songs for Mad Skills. Other than that, I would have been working at the post.
Get closer to your speaker. It's Mad Skills, the mic freaker. The coolest technician, ill break beat seeker. You're feeling weaker when I begin to come in. Whack MCs are like abortions, cause I ain't having none of them. So break it down for me, I can't understand. Nowadays, you got more rappers than you got fucking fans. And man, listen, that's a pity. That shit wouldn't come off the shelves if an earthquake hit the stick. If they ain't pulling blunts, they pulling triggers. I'm getting tired of DJ Nobody and MC New Nigga. I start ciphers for self in dark alleys. I wreck shows lovely cause I got 9 personalities.
You talk about Mad Skills, and that was 95 if I'm not mistaken.
96 was the record dropped, was from where?
Right.
Okay, so
it dropped the same day as the Fugees and Tupac.
Yeah, different thing.
Wow.
But, you know, the fact that you had like three songs. So the fact that you had 3 in a sea of like Illmatic type producers, I mean, you had Buck Wild, you had
Dilla.
I mean, it was crazy.
Large Pro.
It was crazy. Yep. I mean, did you feel competitive or were you just happy to have like the opportunity? I mean, not many people thought about that back then because in hindsight, it's hard, but.
Totally happy to have the opportunity. I mean, that's really what, you know, I didn't even think about it because you don't technically know all the people that are on an album. Like, you know, I heard some songs, right?
Yeah.
That were being produced, you know, like Skills were playing in the studio or something, but you don't know the full aspect of who's on it. You know, like Dilla, he was still catching the wave, you know, just really getting to know who he was. Like, I didn't know him, you know, at the time. So, you know, less than him I knew. Buck Wild I knew. So, you know, it was just what you did. You know what I mean? You didn't really kind of think about it. And I was just thankful that, you know, I got the resources from it, was able to do what I love to do, what I set out to do, you know, which obviously continue in music. So, you know, I didn't really look at it as a competition, but like looking back on the album, I'm like, wow, that was an amazing album, just as, you know, the body of work, but then to be alongside all those other producers, you know, I'm definitely grateful for it. So.
Did that album kind of create a launching pad for you? Like, were you in demand after that? Did people start hitting you up or did you go seek projects out?
With seeking projects, I mean, that started it. And then from there, and also through the connection, like say, because the Artifacts world, we knew them being label mates as far as the groups, right? But then when we weren't on the label as a group, they were still there. So I was pursuing, you know, okay, the story is told, like Elder and I, we talk about it, even we've talked about it, you know, on radio when I did something with him, whatever. But I just love them, man. Like, you know, what they did, and they were like super hard, like in the sense of, you know, I bring them tracks and they'd be like, okay, I like that, but that's not it yet. And I just locked in on them, you know, and just really said, okay, well, I'm just going to keep submitting, keep sending, giving them tapes to the point where by the time it was all said and done and the persistence paid off, you know, I ended up doing about half of the That's Them album, you know, because I just kept going in at them, you know, and a lot of times we don't do that. You know, we just kind of, sometimes you spread yourself too thin, just in life in general, you know, and just the difference between broad light, like the sun, and that same sun harnessed as a laser can cut through, you know, can cut through a diamond, you know what I mean? So it just was the whole focus aspect of it that I think got me to the place where I was able to do a lot of, you know, production for different people. Cause it was just, that's what I was doing. You know, it was, there was no plan B. It was just going in, you know?
Well, I say from like 96, 97 is really when you started that run. So like you had mentioned the Skills, you were talking about the That's Them. By the way, many, many artifacts purists will say that That's Them is the best album in their catalog. And I think I love it. I think it's aged well. You produced half of it. Artifacts, the actual single.
Yep.
It's phenomenal.
Right. It's your best song, man.
Right. Thank you, man.
I like to rip off mics and clock off dice that roll funny. Getting blunted off somebody's whole money. Honeys speak for me for cheese, ease back. Please keep that weave intact. Best believe the Tamer D will be back. Get the weed sacks, relax. Fuck a flick from Blockbuster, I'ma touch ya. Proving who got the bomb like Russia. Friendly neighborhood rap hood with goods. Could it be? Yes, no question. Now let's start up the session. Kick a rap out till I black out. Check out when I wreck out, throwing backs out. Laughing out loud when niggas crap out. Me, I want more G's than the LAPD from when I wrote my first rhyme in 83. With each piece release, I reach mad blocks. Analyzing more spots than Matlock. Now I got this rapping shit on padlock. You only half rock. My shit returns like resurrections in religion. Was fucking with the fact we only bullshit.
And then you also did work for Helter Skelter. I know that was, I think a year earlier, it was on the B-side of Therapy. It was Place to Be. Exactly.
Place to Be, yes.
So this is before Sean P became Sean P. But
working
with these cats, you knew what, you know, the whole boot camp duck down thing was like. What was it like working with those guys in particular, Rock and Rook?
Man, you know, it's fascinating, though, and I think about as a producer, you know, no matter what, you could even look at, let's say, a Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson technically only has his career, right? No matter how large you are, you know, those guys have their career. But as a producer, to be able to move around is so awesome. So let's say coming from the Artifacts and the Skills and stuff like that to work with them, they were from Brownsville and, you know, and obviously had a different experience, you know what I'm saying, of life, you know, and they spoke about that. So to work with them, it's like, it was just super cool for me because it was like working with a different type of artist, you know what I mean? And that doesn't mean they were super dope, you know what I'm saying? And it was like, the boot camp welcomed me in, man. And just, you know, I did other songs for like some project like Illinois and some different things.
You did the compilation, the For the People compilation. Yeah. You were on that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and who really brought me in was the Beat Miners, you know, and I met them through a former road manager, Joey, you know, introduced me to them and then to Baby Paul. And Baby Paul technically was the one who said, because I think he did La Fly, the Scorch Guy, I think, mm-hmm. like that, right? So hey, guys, check this guy out. You know what I mean? Then I met, you know, Drew Ha and all the guys. So, The thing when I really look back on it, I was able to be in different groups. Like the Artifacts are from New Jersey, not even from New York. Boot Camp from, you know, Brownsville and that area. You know, most of them from like the downtown Brooklyn area, Flatbush. You know, it's just amazing how as a producer you can just move from group and groupings of people and really tap into their experiences. Yo, you know what I mean? So I'm super happy, man. Grateful for that.
Place to be is on my side, dude, cause you don't wanna be the target when I fly the coop.
Nah, place to be is on my side, dude, cause you don't wanna be the target when I fly the coop.
Buenos Diaz, you know me as Rock L, numero uno papi chulo, sticking dick to your chick culo. Hard to kill like the white boy hatcher, snatch a MC off the rap off the simple fact he's wacko. What's the deal?
What?
I feel you can't step to Sean. Wigging out on bitch ass niggas since Decepticons.
Transform.
The plan's on, but I wish maybe J Block remind me. Take my hoodie off, nigga, I can't see behind me.
You know, before we go into all the Ruckus stuff and kind of the sound that defined the indie era and for the most part defined you in my mind, I just had a kind of a question and just wanted to kind of pick your brain on this. You know, since Timbaland and Missy kind of defined, you know, I want to say 96, 97, the Virginia sound. I mean, did that kind of force your hand to change your style production wise? I mean, because I think in your early career, I hear that you try to kind of break out this jazz style, but it's still kind mm-hmm. of confined in, like, you know, what we knew what hip hop was, you know, and I don't think you really defined your style yet. So I think, like, were things like Timbaland and the sound that was coming out of your hometown, did that kind of force you to change up?
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't live, they're from like the Portsmouth, Virginia Beach, you know, area down there, Norfolk and stuff like that, Hampton. So I'm up just up the road, up 64, you know, but the thing is, I wasn't in Virginia anymore.
Right.
So it was just, my experience was just like everyone else's experience, how they, you know, they came and just really, you know, redefined how people were approaching, you know, music as a whole. So I got it, you know, inadvertently through, not just because they were from Virginia, and, you know, and obviously I'm thankful for that. Like, wow, you know, home state and all of that. But the one thing I saw in Timberland, and thinking back on, if I remember correctly, it was almost like he borrowed some of like the drum and bass type approaches, you know, to things with the hi-hats. I mean, now we have the triplet hi-hats with all the trap stuff, but he was one of the first ones on this side who broke us out of the 1/8 hi-hats and all of that stuff like that.
He did more of the double timing in production. Right. So he would put it on like 180, but yet it would be a 90. You know what I mean?
Right. And that was akin to like drum and bass, like, you know, and I was exposed to it when I was doing work for like remixes, like Four Hero, who was some of the originators, you know, in Europe and stuff like that, of the drum and bass thing. So he just, to me, that their whole thing just pushed music, you know, to another place, which regard, and it kind of broke us out of just the pure head nod.
Right.
You know, and brought us into like a different part of the dance, the swing of the body. You know what I mean? So, of course, you know, it was difficult for me to break away from the jazz, you know what I mean? Because that's, you know, that's what defined it, you know, well, particularly at the time with Tribe, and I'm of the Tribe camp, meaning, you know, everybody kind of has their line that they fall under, you know what I mean? Some people like De La or some different, but I definitely was a Triber, you know what I mean? So, and they constantly use, you know, some amazing jazz samples and stuff. So, but it took me a while. I remember people, I would try to submit songs for different people, you know, maybe a little bit harder artists. And they were like, man, this stuff is too jazzy, man. It took me a while to break away from it, you know? But it's true. And I think, too, listening to the jazz records is really what was influencing me. You know, today I was speaking with Rich Mason, who puts on shows. He's basically a cultural anthropologist, you know, hip hop stuff. He was around when most taking pictures and, you know, all these high school, now he's doing like some high school for like school age kids and basketball, all kinds of things. He's just an amazing guy. And he was just talking about sampling. And he was talking about how the young kids, because they don't sample, they don't necessarily even know the history of music. Because, you know, using the packs and I'm all down for that. But it made me really think, like, wow, I actually learned music through seeking samples.
Yeah,
I didn't appreciate the songs.
Yeah.
I was looking at it more of as a consumer. What can I get from the song, a snare or whatever? But when I think back on it, like the music I just like to sit down and actually listen to, I listen to all that stuff now just for pure pleasure, you know? So I just think it's valuable that we constantly, whether we look back at the Timberlands or beyond, you know, just to see, you know, what other people had, what came before us, you know, what informed where we are now. You know what I mean? So great question, though.
Yeah. And I think that they really took the drum machine and expanded it beyond what it was supposed to do, you know, almost using tricks and little like techniques. And that's, you know, that really is an ode to jazz because it just takes away from the structure of things, you know? So I always right. appreciated his style and where he went with it all. But yeah, now I appreciate that.
All right, so let's get into it. Ruckus Records.
Here we go.
So you and Most Def, you were the man behind his debut single, the much anticipated debut single.
Right.
To me, Most Def was like the poster boy of indie hip hop. He's the guy who, you know, if you had like Public Enemy who maybe created Def Jam or was responsible for that, like Most Def is the reason why there's Ruckus Records, you know?
Right.
So let's talk about the single, right? That was his first single. You did both the A and the B side. You can hear it. And it was Universal Magnetic. Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite indie era track, period.
Oh, man, appreciate it.
Recognize all area crew, whether you speak Japanese or Goonie Goo Goo. Someone I come through, other rappers boo hoo, cause they know they style soft like Baby Doo Doo. I will continue to hit like a fifth, a stolen Naya, putting jokers on ice to get the cream like Briar.
No secret.
Most Dev is the one, the Hunza Maya. I get in my stance to set the dance on fire. Spread out my wings and I take the world high.
Tell us, because this is where you really came into your own, and I think this is where, you know, people know Sean Jay. So before we get into the whole Mike Zune and all the Guess Wild stuff, let's talk about this particular record. You and Most Def, how did that come about? Obviously, you knew Most was going to be the next thing. You know, you worked with Bush Baby, so I'm sure you've heard a lot of the stuff. So, but this record in particular, I think, helped him and helped you, because it really was the start of me thinking that this was what really opened the doors for Ruckus, this record.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Ruckus was, he wasn't the first artist on Ruckus, you know. They were, developing, the artists. And it's interesting, I actually met him through Khalil from the Bush Babies, And Khalil from the Bush Babies actually introduced me and Talib. So that's another subject we can discuss as well. So
sure.
He's a conduit for all of us.
Is that Mr. Man?
Mr. Man, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I was working on the Bush Baby album, and they were friends. He brought him in to do the intro and outro, on the beat I did. So from that point, he brought him to my house. So the Universal Magnetic song itself was actually, they were finishing up their album, the Bush Babies. And I went home, and that night, I speak about it sometimes, but like there was a bird that would, in the morning when I'm working on stuff early in the morning, will be outside the window. So I would just do a lot of like recording things, record sounds and all kinds of stuff. And I recorded this bird, and I'm like, okay. And I was going to the studio the next day to play it for them, to be a part, to try to get this last song on the Bush Baby album. So they liked it, but they were like, nah, this is not, what we're looking for. So when a couple of weeks later, Mr. Man brought Most to the house, and, we were just kicking in and stuff like that, the beats, and he ended up picking that. And Ruckus had approached him, I guess, to give him just a single deal. So basically, that's why it was a single.
Mm-hmm.
So they would say, okay, we're going to try you out, just give you a single. So, they paid him off. He hit me off too. I was grateful for that. And we recorded the album. We actually recorded the song at Skef Anselm's house, of the tribe, Skef Anselm stuff.
Yep.
So we recorded the Universal Magnetic at his house. And, then we, went on and we recorded, if you hung, you can hear, I think we recorded with Duro at Platinum Mile, if I'm not mistaken, but we recorded that somewhere else. But it was, the whole idea was he had a single, he and I starting to get to know each other. And, that's it. I'd heard of him through the Universal Thermal Dynamic or Urban Thermal Dynamic.
Yeah, My Kung Fu.
Right. So, so I had heard of him, but I enjoyed what he did, but it wasn't like he was fully budding at the time. You know what I mean? He was just starting to get his legs on him, and he was doing more like commercials. I think he was doing like a Visa commercial with Deion Sanders. So he's always been multifaceted.
I'll buy 10 of these.
You're Deion Sanders.
Deion Sanders. It's him. You're the greatest, man.
Mind if I get a picture?
Thanks, bro. You mind if I write a check?
Sure, Deion. I'm just going to need to see some ID.
Say what?
So I didn't necessarily view him. I enjoyed what he did. I enjoyed being around him, and, we had a great relationship like that. So I didn't necessarily view it as like, oh, this is going to be the single. But I remember when the song came out, and somebody from Jazzy Jeff's camp hit me up. I think it was Rich Medina. And called me, they said, oh yeah, the song came out, and they asked us to come down there. And I remember that was the kind of the moment in my mind where I was like, oh wow, like this thing could, Jazzy Jeff, this is one of my first records I ever had in my life. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Going to meet him off of doing a song, and that kind of showed me like, wow, like how music can travel, and how influential it is. And how people, want to just talk to and just kind of, get at the people who do things like, different songs or art or whatever. So, but it was a great opportunity for us to do, that song and stuff like that. So, and then obviously he went on to do other things with Ruckus.
I think after his, Stakes Is High appearance, everyone was waiting for this guy to come through. And so let's talk, because you worked a lot with him. You also did a few joints with Mike Zoot. Seems like you were on Guess Wild right. Records. You were on Ruckus Records.
Right. And with Matt Fingers.
Matt Fingers, exactly. High Drama, Part 1 and 3.
Right.
I know,
All in It, All in My Own, which it was a single, but it ended up being on the Lyricist Lounge, I believe it was.
Okay. Lyricist Lounge, you did, was that Action Guaranteed on that, or was it, maybe I'm confusing, the joint with OC and Rascas.
That was Action Guaranteed
with that, the Body Rock, but then it was All On My Own was a song that we did, and I think they featured that on their album, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's it.
For one of the Lyricist Lounge albums.
Well, Lyricist Lounge,
that was the 98 first one.
Well, volume one was with Body Rock. That was
Body Rock, All On My Own, and Action Guaranteed.
Right. So let's talk about Body Rock. So look, Mos is already at this point, you know, he's more established, right? You had Q-Tip, right? Everyone's, you know, favorite. And you had Tash from the Alcoholics Crew. To be the guy to provide that, you know, that beat with three iconic MCs. Mm. I mean, I'll let you speak. I'm not going to speak
Goosebumps,
for you.
Dude.
But that had to be one of the greatest feelings, you know, to find out that was going to be, you know, those guys were going to be on that record.
And up next, we got Katash with that West Coast rhyming. Bombing niggas with the style as dangerous as mountain climbing. Cause the alky words I'm spitting be twisting while you listening. Plus, I'm in this motherfucker with a liquid coalition. That'll leave you in positions. Twisted backwards like yoga. While you staring down my throat like, is he drunk or is he sober? Who knows? All I know is Tash got flows and got the technique to get the ladies out of their clothes. I've been overly exposed to the 40-yos and chickens. So I'ma keep it pumping till the beat stop kicking or till the plot thickens. Cause this is how we do catastrophe most death.
Yeah, but now that you say it, that's funny. I guess I thought about it at the time, but that brings a smile to my face. Not the fact that I did it, but just like when you mentioned the names, well, you know what I mean?
It's crazy.
And yeah, man, we recorded that at our Firehouse Studios in the city. And I remember, you know, Q-Tip came in. You know, obviously Q-Tip was Q-Tip, you know, at the time. He was the dominant, you know, dominant person in hip hop, really. So for him to come in, he came in, you know, listened to it, kind of gave me dap. Yeah, okay, you did this beat, okay, good, you know. And then went in the booth and, you know, recorded and stuff like that. And the interesting thing is, in the beginning of the song, he says why, right? And this kind of this like an ad lib thing. And when I heard that in the beginning of Universal Magnetic, I had recorded Moses' stepson Elijah when he was a young boy, and he was just like saying, you know, like if you say A, B, boys rock the world, why? So with Q-Tip, you know, when he was in the studio and he was doing, he started out with the ad lib, he was saying like, why? And then that let me know he actually listened to Universal Magnetic, like it studied it, because not everybody caught that. So in the beginning,
huge
of Universal
compliment.
Magnetic say, A, B, boys rock the world. It says, why? And I was like, wow, that was Elijah Moses' stepson.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, this guy's actually studied the beat. So that's not something that's really subliminal, you know? So, you know, obviously being in the studio and just hearing them and stuff like that. And it's fascinating because Q-Tip, to tie that whole single around, I had given him a B tape, right? Through, you know, people that we commonly knew. And I saw him on Broadway. This was before even the Body Rock, even the song. Even doing Mos Def, I gave him a tape and he came and I saw him. I approached him on the street. He said, okay, yeah, I like your stuff. And he was just saying how, he said, yeah, we need to do more up-tempo stuff, right? But one of the songs he actually referred to on there was actually If You Hung, You Can Hear. It was on a B tape that I gave him, and he talked to me about it on the street, you know, and then most ended up picking that. So it's kind of full circle how that whole thing comes around,
wow.
You know, but it was dope. And then working with Tash, you know, I mean, with the Alcoholics, man, you know, super dope, you know, as always, man, it just was like you said, when you name the people, you know, it's like, wow, those are some amazing artists, man.
It's crazy. And you know, the funny thing is at that time, I mean, a lot of people, I think, had the misconception that you had a production deal through Ruckus, and they really didn't do that kind of thing back then. And they really didn't do anything but singles. So the fact that you were kind of hanging with Mos at the time, you were probably saying to yourself, damn, I mean, is this guy going to do a record? Am I going to get more on here? I mean, he was one of the first full-length LPs on that label. I mean, what was your thoughts when they finally decided to not just do singles and kind of move into an LP format?
Yeah, well, the thing is, too, and this gets into some of my history and our history together. Like, I was already, I was sampling, but I was playing, too, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing with the album, when I got to the point where I had to say, you know what, I'm not going to sample, my lawyer was like, okay, well, you know, you have to be careful, you know, obviously, you know, people's lawsuits and stuff. And then, you know, I had dedicated, became a more devout Christian and stuff. And I remember I was just, the sample clearance thing, they really teach you to kind of hide and do all this stuff. But I remember, you know, read the scripture, let him who stole steal no more, but let him work with his hands that he may have to give to those in need. And I just couldn't reconcile it. So that's the thing that really, because I made the decision to really stop sampling, it's like, and he wanted to still use tracks that I had, right? But I was like, no, man, I don't even know where I got this stuff from. So it really, me not being on the album was more part of me than him. You know, it was just like, you know, he wanted to use the stuff. I was like, dude, I don't know where it is. And, you know, and we both had certain spiritual, you know, journeys where it was like, you know, even Universal Magnetic, you know, I took it, the beat, original beat was different because he had read this book. It was talking about, he's a devout Muslim, you know, about this horns and bass, like evoke certain evil spirits and stuff like that. So I actually changed the bass on Universal Magnetic. I changed it and ended up playing like a Rhodes, and then I took like a rubber band and like close mic'd it and looped it and like fed it back on itself to create like a bass sound, you know what I mean? So Whoa. That it wouldn't violate my friend, you know what I mean? So we both were going through these spiritual, you know, spiritual journeys, and me not being a part of that album, they wanted me to be, you know, but I turned it down because it was like, I don't have anything to give you, you know, and I had to really relearn, you know, music and my approach, you know, and I've since, like, sampling is not bad, and it was just I didn't want to steal, really what it was, you know, and I didn't have any music to give them, so they moved on. You know what I mean?
That's just a hell of a story. I'll take it personal.
Well, you mentioned going to hiding. So before all that, you were on the Black Star album, right? You were on, I think, Children's Story and Haters Players. You did work with Network Reps. I know Kamani Rogers, the Masterminds, Jay Trends.
Yes.
Frontline collabo, sick. But you mentioned hiding. It seemed like you went into the witness protection program because after this period of time, we didn't hear from you. Matter of fact, this is a true story. I get a record in the mail sometime around 2013, and I open it up, and I wasn't familiar with where it came from. I think it was one record. It was an LP, and I open it up, and all of a sudden, I see Sean J. Period, the Unspoken 90s Volume 1. And not for nothing, I was like, wait a second. Sean J. Is this? Yeah, I had to like almost see if it was the same Sean J. Period. I mean, obviously is, but it was like maybe a decade later. So I'm thinking, what is this? It was cool as shit because one, it was autographed. I'm like, whoa, this is kind of cool. I didn't expect it. And then I'm saying, well, okay, he's back now. And I think that was kind of around the time I had done that piece on the Troy blog about you, which But so what the fuck happened? Where'd you go?
Yeah, I mean, but think about this, like, and it kind of ties into the non-sampling. It was like I didn't have music that I felt like I could present to anybody. You know, I had gotten married at the time, you know what I mean? And it was just more or less a thing of everybody else is not going to sit and wait for me to figure out my sound and what I want to do. You know, these guys are rolling. So it's just a natural thing. The people I was with, you know, they're moving on. Black Star's blowing up and, you know, life is moving. You know, I'm newly married at the time and, you know, just kind of pull back, you know, and from that perspective, it's like, you know, life doesn't wait, bro. It's like, so guys, you know, they're doing it. And the thing is, too, like when you mentioned the Troy blog, at the time, because I think it was, it was multiple articles. Done about it. It wasn't the first Troy blog. Like, I remember somehow just, you know, I was just working and stuff like that. And it was, I just happened to like, you know, online is growing and stuff. And I just say, you know, I just wanted to look up my name just to see what people were writing about. And the Troy blog, I remember reading it, and it just made me like, I want to say that was so important to me, because it was like, wow. Like, you know, somebody still is even thinking about me, you know, and in an informed way, you know what I mean? So I wanted to tell you too, that I really appreciate that.
Well,
it really just made me think, like, you know, that it's not like I've stepped away, and because I'm not talking to most of them, they're all doing their thing or whatever.
Sure.
I wasn't talking to anybody in music. You and I don't know each other, but yet and still you thought to write something. You know what I mean? So I say publicly, dude, I really appreciate that. Cause that helped me to just know, like, okay, you know, what I did had at least some value. You know what I mean?
Without question.
And, you know, and then, yeah. And then the records you got, my friend Fred, would just tip me, yeah, man, I want to put out some vinyl. And those were songs, those were beats that I did. Those were my experimental beats right after I stopped working with most of them. And so really those beats were the transition beats that when I wasn't sampling, but I was like figuring out what I wanted to do. My sound sources were, you know, not from records, but more like sample CDs, or, you know, I was just really experimenting. So that stuff is important too. And that's why I'm assuming he got that too.
I'm holding the record right now. I'm looking at it. Yeah, I mean, this was mailed to me. And like I said, you signed them. I don't know if you signed all of them, but you happened to sign this particular one.
Right, right.
And yeah, man, it really was a great record. But touching on what you had said, and by the way, I do appreciate, you know, those comments. But I think I was speaking for, you know, a legion of people. I mean, there was that void because people got so accustomed to those Sean J beats. And, you know, to give you credit, the fact is this was a time where you really did make a name. And then years went by and they didn't have that sound. So I think
you're being
modest, but I'm sure you had to turn down a lot of opportunity because after those years, I had to imagine you had a lot of people knocking on your door for a Sean J beat. Because like I said earlier in the interview, you're one of the handful of producers that I really think helped, you know, shape the sound of this indie hip hop movement that we had.
Yeah. The thing is too, I mean, I definitely appreciate, you know, your words too. The thing is people didn't really know where I was. I was in Brooklyn, you know what I mean? Just working and stuff, married, kid, you know, stuff like that. And it just, I wasn't even focused on it. If anything, I became more just disillusioned with, like, you know, music is supposed to, I had it in an improper place in me, almost like it was my savior. You know what I mean? And, you know, when you go through different things, it's not. It's just an opportunity that you get, you know, to express your art and, you know, who you are. And you can't determine whether people are going to like it or not or do whatever. It's just an opportunity to present your art, you know. And I'm grateful for, you know, the people who, you know, have liked it, you know. But the thing is, music was going through just a major change then. You know, you had the industry where, you know, all of a sudden Napster, the three I read in a book, it was like three things happened. You know, you had the CD, which digitized music, the internet, and the personal computer. All of those three things coming together fuel the, you know, the file sharing thing and all of that. And everybody's just kind of like, you know, is the music industry over? And, you know, independent music always, 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 no matter what happens, always is a steady line through. But it was an identity crisis even there, because it's like you had guys who were still doing, quote unquote, the type of stuff that I was doing, right? But they were trying to figure out where, you know, do I continue to do this? So I think that people weren't necessarily looking for me because they were trying to figure out for themselves.
Everyone had access at that point. You know, it's like it was easy to go to Sam Ash and pick up a, you know, a full MIDI production studio in one box. It was easy to go and listen to your favorite thing at the Knitting Factory, where producers would be on stage trying to, you know, basically do a beat showcase or something like that. But that's the thing.
Right.
You could have totally taken advantage of those opportunities. So I guess, you reverted to being a family man and things that were important to you.
Right.
And I would assume you went for a regular 9-to-5 type job, but what was the catalyst that made you say, okay, like something's missing. And, you know, how am I going to interject myself back into the mainstream of what shaped me, what I love? Because you got to remember, I say this to my wife all the time, and she hates when I say it, but my longest relationship is with hip hop. And I think that goes for you as well. And, you know, a lot of women or wives or spouses want to know that, you know, they were number one. But the truth is, I have been doing this.
We can all say this, I think.
No, listen, I have been doing this my whole life, and I have had ups and downs with it, and I have questioned myself, and I have done the non-sampling thing for a while. Then I got back into sampling. I mean, all of these things have kind of shaped the ups, the downs, the ebbs, the flows. But at the end of the day, I can sit in my room and listen to 30 plus years of making music or making old mixtapes, and I can like look back and say, like, first of all, I'm happy that I have this documented, whether it's on a floppy disk or whatnot. But like, this is such an important time for me personally, like, to be alone and say, look at what you've done, look at what you've accomplished. And I think that when you have done that, obviously in the past, you had to have said, you know, I don't want to be an ego-driven person in this world of like ego-driven hip hop, but like, I meant something to this era of hip hop, and you should be one proud. But what was the catalyst that interjected you back into the scene?
Yeah, and I mean, I had little fits and starts. Like you said, the album, the Unheard '90s and stuff, did some like an album with Carl Injects and Tyler from the Root Movement. You know, little fits and starts.
Right,
but. I was on Facebook, you know, and a gentleman named DJ Olo hit me up about coming to DC to judge a producer showcase, because you had mentioned that earlier. So, and I'm thinking like, okay, you know, if I produce, and it's like, but when I got there, I remember walking in, you know, and it was just like, dude, like I'm home. It was like a fish in water.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't necessarily, it was like I met Cardia Latif and some different people. Like, and I'm like, dude, like I remember walking in the place and, you know, sitting down and people, they were listening. They were paying attention to, you know, the thing and hold it in whatever regard they do. But it got me off the sofa, quote unquote, and out. So they brought me down to DC. I start, you know, and to this day, I've judged, you know, a slew of things for them. You know what I mean? Always doing stuff for them. Coming back to judge on the beat circuit is really what my contribution, because I'm also giving advice to young guys coming up. You know what I mean? I'm not just holding on to things that I learned. I'm able to speak about it. And I do a lot of private mentoring to different people. Like I met, you know, one of my best friends, Kelsey, you know, I manage him and we work together and stuff like that on the beat circuit with, you know, Masters of the Machine, with Kaz and Motif, you know what I mean? So it's like, and then to find out like the Beat Society, right? So Olo is part of the Beat Conductors, right? DC. But then to find out what you're saying, people were doing beat events. I had no clue, dude. I'm like, I'm 9-to-5 guy working, whatever. But then like Beat Society, you know, they were doing it big. I mean, because 88 really brought Kanye there. You know what I mean? And then that's how he and Illmind connected and just all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm oblivious to this stuff.
Right.
And so now to come back and be introduced to the Beat Conductors and Olo and then all of this stuff, it's like I'm so fulfilled. Not that it's the total thing I'm doing, right? But it's like it's such a fulfilling thing for me to do, to be able to just sit and to really hear the growth of the producers. You know, because they don't have necessarily the opportunities that like they have more opportunities to expose themselves through social media and all of that stuff like that. But it's harder for producers to make any type of name now.
Yeah, it's harder to break through. There's too much clutter.
So many people, because oftentimes you were prohibited by having equipment or not.
Yeah.
Some people would have to pay to go to the studio to use a sampler. Right. So the guys who you saw advance, their mothers, you know, bought them. I mean, you hear Kanye's mom talk about had bought him a sampler. My cousin and I, Jeremy, we had, in college, they throw in credit cards at you. We took two credit cards and a little cash and went and bought the EPS 16 Plus, you know what I'm saying, that I used for the Down South album and then the most stuff and all. You know what I mean? So you were hindered by equipment, whereas now equipment is really not even the thing. Sounds is really not the thing. Yeah. It's just what do you do?
Right.
So these guys, like, oh, I'm not getting a placement, and the placements are less. Because it's, the record, you're not putting out but so many records as far as big names,
right?
But you have more opportunity. So that's how I really gotten back in. And I mean, I love mentoring producers and just, doing all this stuff. So that's what brought me back in.
When you sit down and reflect on your discography and all the songs you made, what are a couple that you think are your very best and why?
Man, okay, I have to say, I'm not going to pick the obvious ones, because one record that I loved was The High Drama, because it had, Mos on it, Mike Zoo, Quali, but it's a verse that Consequence did on one of the High Dramas. I love that verse. Like, Consequence is so dope, man.
Watch this, I'm in the top, let's dodge wiper. Notice I'm being tailed by a bird on a wire. Take me for a loose, he better start flicking lighters. We could kick game or become karate fighters. Heard I was pitching, curveball or slaughter. Out the laundromat, in the number 8 dryer. While I caught this buyer, he's in well-dressed attire. But every time he spoke, he talked into his collar. And I ain't full of smoke, this nigga gave me more dollars. So I jumped out, running out in front of Judy's beauty parlor.
You know, so stuff like that. And, there's a song Most did for Funkmaster Flex. I'm actually using it as part of a tag for the new sound design company I'm launching, Drumstack. So it's the thing he did for that. So it's like a lot of the obscure stuff. You know, someone recently sent me something online. We did a remix for this group called Whale in Europe. The song was Crying at Airports. And I remember, like, the beat was kind of this offbeat, kind of reggae kind of thing, and Most came in and just killed it. You know what I mean? The work I did with DJ Crush in Japan, like the Four Heroes remix stuff, and just kind of the obscure stuff. I'm starting to find out, like, when I listen to it, like, first of all, I forgot, it's not like in the top of my mind. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But, like, I really appreciate that stuff. And then, like, I was listening to the Artifacts album. I was talking to L the other day, and I had to call him and tell him, man. I talk to L pretty often. And I was just like, dude, I really appreciate you all giving me this opportunity, man, to really do that many songs on that album. When I sit back and listen to it, I'm like, wow, man. Like, and not from wow, oh, Sean, you did this thing, but just as a piece of art, you know what I mean? It's like, I just was so grateful, man. So it's in so many different little pockets of things, man. So.
Well, a lot of us feel that Artifacts is either their number one or two best song ever. You can't front on Wrong Side of the Tracks. Probably their best.
I'm on Wrong Side of the Tracks.
But after that, it's Artifacts, straight up.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of a universal truth. Everybody knows.
Yeah, that song, that song actually came before the Mos Def stuff, So because it came before that, it really, that the Artifacts song was really the first single. Like, the stuff I did for Bad Skills were really album songs, right?
Right.
They weren't out on singles and stuff like that. So, but the Art of Facts was really
lead single,
the first independent single,
mm-hmm,
that came out, that was being, really pushed on the radio, independent radio and stuff like that. So
it made an impact that immediately,
was really
though, man.
Big catalyst for me.
I mean, that was a big college radio song. I mean, it made an immediate impact.
Before we wrap up, because we've had you for a minute, I definitely appreciate you giving us your time.
Okay.
What, let the listeners know what's on deck. What can they expect to hear from Sean Jay in 2020? What should we be on the lookout for?
Yeah, like I said, doing more like judging, a lot of the events. You're going to do like a Dilla Day down in D.C. About to launch my sound design company, Drumstacks. Doing a lot of work, man. Just like, the thing with, like, let's say the drum stacks, you know, a lot of guys are putting out the kits and stuff like that. And because I want to approach it like I approach with just everything, a lot of experimentation and stuff, you know, I'm just end up doing it for like $39.99. People pay one time instead of keep paying over and over and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going, as I'm experimenting with all kinds of stuff that I've just been doing the whole time, I just add it in there to get it. You know what I mean? So it really, you know, people pay a little bit to get in, but it's like, I'm just so passionate now and so excited about just experimenting with sounds and like seeing young producers really grow to not only as like musicians, but just as people, you know what I mean? Like that's when I say really efficient water, you know, that's where I'm at, man. And it's like being around these young producers, Kelsey and Flames Emoji and Motif Alumni, you know, G-Wiz, all these guys, you know, it's just like, I just love these. It's like all, you know, I'm the only boy, you know, like I have a sister, right? But, and also there's some dope females too, bro, who produce, are killing it. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, you have, I'm so excited about the producer pool that's coming out. You know what I mean? And whatever I could do to just help to better that. So that's where you're going to see me. You know what I mean? And eventually producing records, like I just did a record with DCQ, Moses' brother, who was on Crosstown yep. Beef. He was in the group Urban Thermodynamics with them, and, you know, just doing some different stuff. But it's a lot based around producers and helping to bring them to the next level.
Well, that was going to be my final question was, as a producer yourself, do you keep tabs on what currently goes on? Because the jazzy sound that we all love here at this table, while it's still there, it's not as prominent as it once was. And you have the drumless rap, you know, it's a little different these days. So do you keep an ear to the streets? Like, do you have a pulse on what is currently going on with hip hop?
For sure.
Okay.
For sure. And I mean, even like you say, whether it be the underground type stuff, which is still totally alive and well, you know, with the Homeboy Sandmans and all these, you know, Kev Brown, all these different people, right?
Mm.
But then you have the trap stuff, right? And I'm not one of the older guys who, I actually like trap. I hear it for what it is. They took an 808 sound. I mean, because that's the kind of the dominant thing that really, that in the hi-hat.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it, just like we talked about Timbaland, you know, Timbaland was flipping it up with the hi-hats and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, we needed to go somewhere other than, right?
Yeah.
So I get that. And then they took the 808 sound and brought out the upper harmonics, put the saturation on it, played it like a bass line. Like, you have to think that stuff is cool, man.
Yeah, the crazy thing is the Miami sound was doing that back in the 80s, but I right. totally understand what you're talking about.
Yeah. The problem I have with it is that everything sounds the fucking same now.
And it does, and then it doesn't. Like, and that's where, like, if you really, and this is just coming from a person who I always try to, like, give each group just a fair shake. You know what I mean? Like, now our stuff may have been, because look at what we were borrowing from.
Right.
We were borrowing from actual musician stuff, right? Horn players and just all this stuff like that, chopping and doing all this stuff. Whereas the reference point, they're really taking a couple of VSTs and playing and doing whatever. And it's a certain bounce and they're not necessarily doing full production type stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're just dropping simple. Out and
but
doing,
then you, have some,
you know,
yeah, but then
the low
you have
passes.
Some really complicated stuff, too. You listen to one of, like, the Migos album. Some of that production is complicated, man.
The production,
you know what I mean?
I don't have a problem with. I think it's the content that I have, and I think many of us boom bap dinosaurs, whatever you want to call us.
Or lyrical guys who just care about the lyrics.
It's, you know, the trap music, I could listen to an instrumental all day. You put on, you know, Future or whoever it is, a young well, not
speak
young
for yourself,
money, young thug.
No, but the
beats are fine. It's the content that it's lacking.
Right.
You know,
they're not all Kendrick. I mean,
well, yeah. So, all right.
But, and I mean, look, but you think, but look back at, like, if you really look back into our history, not everybody was coming. You know, we would talk about all kinds of stuff like back then. So it's really like you can't really, like, the artists. That's what they're hearing. They're seeing. And really the crowd, the consumer is calling for it, because the consumer doesn't necessarily want deep lyrics. You know what I mean? They just want to escape in this music. Like, life is hard or something. You know what I mean? They don't want something making them think too much.
But hip hop was always hip. It's no longer hip. It lost the hip, and it's a little more hop now, and that's a problem.
Our kids don't think we're hip, so it's more, you know, it goes with the times.
But I do keep my ear to it. I can't say I fully have mastered how to do it, you know what I mean, because my sensibilities come from where they come from. But I have guys around me who show me different stuff, and I appreciate it, you know what I mean, what it is. Like you said, content-wise, you know. But back in the day, all the content wasn't great either. You know what I mean? It's just.
But there was 10 of them rather than 10,000.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're awash in everything because of just how technology has allowed everybody in the pool. So that's really what it is.
I just think the writing is lazy. When you had people, like when Q-Tip made fun records, silly records, if you will, when he went solo. It was fine because it wasn't lazy. It was
even LL. His stuff LL. Was silly and stupid, Jingling Baby, but yet it had so much to it.
It was cool. And I think flavor. Once you reach a certain plateau, it's very hard to go back. But look, we could talk for hours and hours. And I want to get you on the show again. It's been it's been great talking to you. I'm glad the listeners, there's been many, many people that, like I said, have just questioned, you know, what happened to you and wanted to know your story. So I do appreciate you giving us your time and telling the people, you know, the story of Sean J. Period.
Thank you, man. And I really appreciate you just keeping, you know, my name alive, man. Just like, you know, that's super important to me, man. I have to reiterate that to you over and over, bro. Like it makes me feel good, you know what I mean? Like in the sense of, you know, that someone was thinking about it, you know what I mean? Because we're just young kids just doing what we want to do, doing what we love. We're not even really thinking about where it's going to be in the future. So I really appreciate just what you've done, not only for me, but just like your platform, you know what I mean? You could have moved on and said, we're going to do this, but you stayed with a group of people that are no longer the end thing. But yet and still you talk to and you approach it as if, you know, it is the end thing. You know what I mean? So I can say from myself and everybody who represents that era, we really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you, man. It's hip hop, man.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think paying it forward is such an underrated thing that many don't go into because it's such an ego driven, you know, business at one point. But what you're doing and I think what we try to do here on the show is just be around like minded people. Appreciating what we knew was so important and shaped us emotionally, mentally, politically, on every facet of life. And, you know, with the utmost respect, man, we respect everything you've done and we really appreciate you.
Cool. Thank you. You too.
Perfect, bro. Perfect. Thanks I appreciate so much, everything.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
This is Sean J. Period. You're checking out Take It Personal Radio with Philip Flavor, Kevlar, A.A. Ron, and DJ 360. Y'all know these brothers are keeping it alive. Hip hop.
We hope you enjoyed the interview with producer Sean J. Period, only here on Take It Personal Radio. And don't forget, we have a new IG page at Take It Personal Radio. So be sure to follow and get in the discussion. As always, we appreciate our listeners and will continue to bring you the content that matters. Stay tuned for all upcoming episodes as we keep bringing exclusive content and discussions only here on Take It Personal Radio.